Als je het doet, als je wat inbouwt voor divers is Afrikaans. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. Now, ladies and gentlemen, as you know, we had commenced on a conversation that is worth having. We're talking about you. We're talking about you and how you deal with your love. We're talking about different kinds of abuse, but not in the context that you are used to, but in the context of what actually goes down there by you and yourself. How do you do it, you winner? Because we're talking about emotional abuse, ladies and gentlemen, and we're talking about self-emotional abuse, not just any kind of emotional abuse, but self-emotional abuse. The reason that I want to talk about this is because I feel that many of us are emotionally abusive, but we're not emotionally abusive towards other people. We're emotionally abusive towards ourselves. There are different kinds of abuse. There's financial, there's spiritual, there's religious, and physical, those ones, yeah. All in one category. There are different kinds of abuse, and all these kinds of abuse have their own impact and have their own trauma. They have their own ideation. They have their own feel to it. But I wanted to talk about emotional abuse specifically because, right, I believe that we're drowning and we are drowning ourselves. It's not even somebody else that's doing it. It's ourselves that are doing it. And when you're in an emotionally abusive situation, right? Sometimes you don't even fathom that you're in it. Sometimes you don't even know what the signs are. Sometimes you don't know nothing. Sometimes you are just there. You are calling the person, oh, but you're so mean and you're so bad and you're so what and you're so what. Marakanti. They are not bad. They're abusive. So what happens when you are the perpetrator? What happens when you are the bad guy in your own story? What happens if the boogeyman that you have been waiting for, to come and traumatize you, to come and beat you up, to come and abuse you, does not come? Because many of us were told about the boogeyman. The boogeyman is a scary theory that children are told. Okay, English children. I don't know. Opaholi in Afrikaans. Opaholi, there's an Opaholi. And there is Baba Yaga in, it's the Germans and the Jews. There's Baba Yaga. And then in English, there is the boogeyman. And I think Shimbungu. It's not Shimbungu. No, there was Shimbungu and Karanje. That's the bear and the jackal, I think. Oh, whoever. You know, it was the bear and the fox. I don't know. I don't know what you call them. Shimbungu is most now what? A bear. So it was Shimbungu na Karanje. Those two were basically just tit for tat. You take, I take. It was just a Tom and Jerry situation. But we also had a boogeyman as Vambu kids that grew up in the village. We also had a boogeyman, and the boogeyman was Efifimbera. Yeah, I don't know. But it was, now it's a bad thing because we're like, yo, wait a minute. Because we're now we know most that, no. It's not supposed to be like that. But in general, we are told that the boogeyman is an external being. The boogeyman is a being that thrives on manipulation, gaslighting, and eating children and harming children. The boogeyman is not friendly. The boogeyman pretends to be friendly. The boogeyman is trickerous. The boogeyman is trickerous to get you in isolation and then do whatever they want to do to you. So in most cases, we are told about the boogeyman coming, and the boogeyman has a white van without windows, and there's a lot of sweets and a lot of candy. And we mustn't take it because the boogeyman is bad. Mm? So we anticipate this boogeyman to be an external being. And that is why in most abuse cases, especially when it comes to child abuse, it is the most hardest thing to fathom as a child, that the people that are supposed to protect you, the people that are supposed to keep you safe, are the same people that are harming you. That is why it is so difficult for children to, not to snap out of it, but to heal from trauma caused by parents and caretakers and guardians and adults, because they are not supposed to do that. And also because we are waiting for whom? We are waiting for the boogeyman, because the boogeyman is the bad guy. The boogeyman is the guy that comes and does the bad things. But now if you live with Baba Yaga, who shall that fierce? Hmm? It is that boogeyman that stands outside of schools and has a van, and the children, I don't know, my voice sounds very hoarse today. I don't know. I had a long day. I always have long days, but I've had a long day. So if you are listening to me, you're like, yo, girl, what's up, dude? Yeah, sorry, guys. Today the voice is just not voicing. Ha. Not that it voices usually, but usually it's more soothing. Mm. Today it's very rough. Today it's very out there. But also, I think that it is important for it to be very clear and very well articulated, because these are conversations that are very, very vital. We're talking about self-emotional abuse. And I don't know if it's a thing or not, because as far as I'm concerned, I just know a little bit, not as much. But I would say that we are going to diagnose it as self-emotional abuse. And we're talking about the foundation of it, and the foundation starts with the very beginning. The very beginning is what we think of it, what we think of abuse in general, what we think of neglect in general, what we think of bad activities happening to us in general. In general, we say that the people that are supposed to hurt us are outsiders. Because outsiders don't know us personally. Outsiders don't care about us. Outsiders are outsiders. Outsiders are not obligated. Hmm? They're not obligated to care about us. They're not obligated to love us. They're not obligated to look out for us. And this is why, because on this theory alone, can we talk about women that beat other women when they are found with their men? I don't understand that. I don't understand that, because as far as I'm concerned, this woman was proposed just like I was proposed. So the common denominator here is the person in the middle. The person in the middle is the one that has an obligation to me. The person that is in the middle here is the one that knows of my existence, knows of my position, knows of everything. Mm? Knows of the marital status or the relationship status. It is only he that knows. In this three people dynamics, right? I know and he knows, and the likelihood of her not knowing is extremely high, because she has no obligation to me. And I don't understand why women call up other women and say like, yeah, stay away from my man. I would say that if you're going to call her, because sometimes you just need to call her, because you need to understand that sometimes you know your cockroach, right? And you're like, hey, this guy must have said other things, right? You call her to verify. But the exchange between one another must be respectful. It must be authentic. It must not be something that is outside of a movie where we are beating each other and pulling each other's wigs off, because why? Because the boogeyman is supposed to come from outside. And as far as we're concerned, the boogeyman is hurtful. The boogeyman does not care about us. And that is what the other woman is. She is the boogeyman, right? From this theory that we're having, the other woman is the boogeyman. The boogeyman is not obligated under any circumstances to look out for your feelings. The boogeyman is not obligated under any circumstances to look out for you to make sure that your person is faithful to you. The boogeyman is not obligated, right, by any law to not have fun with this person, regardless, because the boogeyman does not know you personally. So unless the boogeyman is your sister, unless the boogeyman is your cousin, unless the boogeyman is your friend, unless the boogeyman is an associate, right? Then the boogeyman can do whatever they want. If the boogeyman is any of these things, then yes, I understand why you're mad. But if the boogeyman is none of these people, then the boogeyman can do as they please. Many of us always want to beat other women for sleeping with our men. But the truth is that these women were most probably just in quiet corners, and the men that we have are the ones that approached them. And they are the ones that brought them into the situation. So check yourself, because the boogeyman, if you look at it from the perspective of a boogeyman, the boogeyman is dangerous. The boogeyman does harm, but the boogeyman is not invested in you. The boogeyman is not emotionally invested in you. The boogeyman doesn't care about your mother's cancer. The boogeyman doesn't care about your 20 years together. The boogeyman does not care. And that is why the boogeyman has a car, has a van with no windows. Why? Because he doesn't even care if you're going to get oxygen or not, because the aim is not to keep you alive. You understand what I mean? So if you apply that to every single being out there, you'd understand better when things happen, because nobody's obligated to be loyal to you. Nobody's obligated to respect you. And this thing of saying, yeah, women to women, like, stop addressing the wrong party. You people are so afraid of the partners that you guys are having. You guys are not addressing the perpetrator. The perpetrator is watching you two beat each other. But the perpetrator is the only one that knew. The perpetrator is the only one that knew that he is in a relationship with you, and he's not supposed to be in a relationship with another person. He's the only one that knew that he's supposed to be monogamous here. But yet, he's not getting any backlash. You guys are beating each other. Like, yeah, calling each other all kinds of names. Like, what is wrong with you, sister? Eh? Are you fine? It's not supposed to be like that. It's supposed to be you addressing your person. And you might be mad at the other party, but the truth is that they didn't do anything to you. The sooner you get over that, the better. Not unless they are a relative, they are somebody close to you, then you can say, "Kucha, yeah, no, but this is my sister. This is my sister, this is my cousin. She knows and he knows, so both of them are cockroaches. Yeah, let's do that." So we're talking about emotional abuse. So in general, we view abuse as something that must come from outside. We don't view it as something that is internalized. We don't view it as something that can come from people that have our best interests at heart, because we assume that everybody that we live with, especially when growing up, has our best interests at heart. Why? Because they pick us up when it's raining. Two, they cook for us. Three, they take care of us. They stay home when they're supposed to be going to parties, because nobody else is going to stay with the kids. They have the responsibility of being our guardian. And part of being our guardian is making sure that we are not in harm's way. And then we get into harm's way, and it's from a guardian, and it just messes us up deeply. It messes us up, and because the whole time we are thinking that the boogeyman is the guy that we must run away from. The boogeyman is outside, and then the boogeyman is inside. So with this said, are you your own boogeyman? Are you your own boogeyman? Are you terrorizing yourself? Are you terrorizing yourself and you don't understand why you are the way you are, but it's because you are the terrorist in your life? Are we self-destructing? Are we beating ourselves to the pole and then not looking back, not looking frontwards? We're just there, eyes closed and everything. Are we playing crucifix and crucifier? Crucifix, yeah, the one that's crucifix Ah, crucified. Yeah. Are we playing the judge and the jury at the same time? Are we playing the perp, the judge and the jury at the same time? What are we doing? We're talking about emotional abuse, self perspective, because I feel that many of us are self-sabotaging. Many of us are beating ourselves down. Many of us are actually the perpetrators in our own lives. So when you are in an abusive situation, it's not easy to identify what is wrong. And sometimes it might be easier to identify when somebody else is doing it to us, because, right? It's easier to identify when somebody else is doing it to us because they are somebody else. And to some degree, even if we are so messed up and even if we are so, you know, even if we are so deep and far gone within the abuse spectrum, right? We can still say that you can identify to some degree when somebody is mistreating you or when somebody is just not doing nice things to you. You can somewhere, somehow identify it. But can you say the same for yourself? Can you say that I can identify when I am self-abusing? I can identify when I am self-harming, because there are so many people that have done catastrophic things to themselves. And we're not just talking suicide here, because I think that many of us think that people just wake up and bam, I'm suicidal now. Oh, I'm going to do it. No, there are other little things that trickle towards the deed. Many. Trickle towards the deed, trickle towards the deed. That trickling towards the deed, right? If we identify that we are abusing ourselves to some degree, would it not be easier for us to stop it while it's early? We can stop anything while it's early, because it hasn't gone in its deep form yet. It has not gone that deep into the heart yet. And it has not done much we are stuck and we can't do much about anything. So it's not that bad. So let's start with our first transcript for the day. And we are going down with, when you're in an abusive situation, it's easy to miss the subtle early signs that built up to a persistent undercurrent of abusive behavior. So when you are in it, it's very difficult for you to say that, you know what, this sign might be a red flag for me to run, because this might be abusive. It's very difficult because we believe in second chances. It's natural for us as beings to believe in second chances and to also not read too much into it. Because if you're going to be a dud about everything, you read too much into everything. That's why people say, Kampala topi. Hey, Kampala. Relax. You know, it's not that deep. Yeah? A lot of people say that it's not that deep. Yeah. You know, when I think of certain things, I think of the interactions that I have with clients. Now, I'm one of those no-nonsense aunties. And I think I'm one of those no-nonsense aunties because I work very hard for what I have. And some people want to walk all over you with that. Customer is always right nonsense, and I send it back very quickly. So we had this client. Her gift package had expired. Like, maybe it didn't expire. It was finished. It was done. But she kept making appointments, right? She kept making appointments for that particular thing that is done. And then, but she didn't manage to get an appointment because, hello. So the last time, I was trying to be nice the whole time. So the last time I told her that I know that you're trying to steal services, right? But if you're struggling at this point, right, just speak to me. Speak to me instead of trying to steal from me. Because if you're trying to steal from me, it's not going to end well. And then she's like, yeah, oops, sorry. I don't know how I didn't have enough gift packages, or I don't know how I missed that. I already used my gift packages. And sorry. Like, no, she didn't say sorry. She said she missed it. Then I was like, okay, it's fine. And I tell her that, yeah, but I think at some point you knew because we spoke about this like at least 3 times already. So each time you're just trying your luck. And then she's like, it's not that deep. And then I said, it is actually that deep. It's actually that deep because you want to play it off as something small, but you want to be a criminal. You want to be a criminal, and then we must play it off as something small and to make you not be embarrassed of your criminal behavior. How? And then we went at it. Yeah. Yeah. Because me, I go at it with clients. Emotional abuse involves attempts to frighten, control, or isolate you. This type of abuse doesn't involve physical violence, though it might evolve to physical violence, but eventually from the beginning as emotional abuse, it doesn't start with physical violence. Because first of all, I have to make you emotionally scared. I make you feel and think that something's going to happen to you, and one day I'm just gonna snap, right? And I'm just going to touch you one day. But it involves mainly threats of violence. Yeah. So I'm gonna beat you. Threats of violence. Which I'm gonna beat you, and I'm gonna stab you, and I'm gonna kick you, and I'm gonna shoot you with this gun, and I'm going to what? There's an aunt of mine that had, today is Tuesday. So on Sunday evening, last Sunday, on Sunday evening, let me just give you guys the full story. So my uncle had passed away a couple of years ago, and we most now didn't have a whole body to bury him. So basically we did a ceremony of taking his clothes home, of which it is usually done by people. You take his belt, you take his shoes, you take certain things, like certain things that say that a man has fallen. So we did the ceremony of taking his things home and mourning without a body and gathering still and singing, and then the distribution, and then the name calling, and then also those that had, that he had debts of, to be paid back and all of that. So we proceeded basically with the beginning of a funeral process and the ending of a funeral process. We just didn't do the memorial and we did not do the burial, you know, because at the end of the day, we didn't have a body to bury. Okay. So there's this particular lady that came. Now this lady is somewhere around my age, right? And she's been married for like 10 years or something like that. She's married to Ommateo Ponkunda. So it's like a childhood friend, a childhood love, a childhood sweetheart. So they've been together since Kingdom Come, basically. So they taught each other everything. They grew up together. So this particular cousin of mine, when she got there, she was weeping because my uncle was her go-to person, like confidant and all of that. And also sometimes, he would visit and then he would also just go rough up the husband a little. Like that, a little bit, and it was more chilled. So she was crying on the fact that Onraminiwai, like, her protector had passed away. We didn't understand. We were just like, oh, okay, cool. Because he was many things for many people. So she was crying, and from the beginning of our whole process, right? Ever since she came, she's just crying about how hard marriage is. And then she went to sit with the grandmothers as well. And then she went to complain about her husband. And she went to say that her marriage is a nightmare and she hates it and she wants to leave and she doesn't want to be there anymore. And as the elders do, you know, and then they make it on Jagana. Like, oh, personally for me, I told her she must leave. Like, for me, I was like, ooh, if you're not happy, sis, run. If you need money to run, holla. If you need a place to crash, holla at your girl. I got you. As long as you don't end up in a casket, sister. And the way she was crying, it was like, it's a deeper cry. It's like a person that's crying everything out. That's what she was doing. A person that's crying everything out. It was wild. And she cried and she cried and she cried. And it was hard. It was hard to watch, hard to be a part of, but she cried, man. But she cried a deeper kind of sadness. She cried a sadness that was made out of fear. And then at some point, her husband came to check in the afternoon and like, she was like, oh, okay, you know, so he's like, there with our family and he's most like, oh, babe and my love. And she's not buying it. You could see on her face. So from the first day until the very last day, she's just crying on Jokan, on Jokan, on Jokan, on Jokan, on Jokan. I hate it on Jokan. I don't want to be there. And then she also said that at some point she had tried to leave and the man had followed her and threatened her. And you know, most when it comes to threats and all of that, I was like, ah, no, leave the guy. Maybe you should go to the city. Maybe you should go away. Maybe you should do this. Okay. So on Sunday, right? On Sunday, she and her husband had an argument. And this argument was so bad. So this guy pulls out a gun and shoots her. Like, and she falls to the ground. Like, but she falls on her stomach. And then he turns the gun on himself. And then he killed himself. And the whole family was like, oh, good riddance.
Onda karahandu yako parates morwe data. Paife, ohandimo kuyadi. Nondaka, ne data, no shoyo o tumaraka mahupi. O netwe kaime, okufutarume, o kuyingarume, oku japandali, fio papa ndaoka. Onda pumga o netwe kaoyo, hai dira ya fang, o mafikwame, o handi streaming, o mafikwame, o handi popi, o mafikwame, o handi nigaishe, poshikanto shime. Pamina parateza, oinda holora, ameha ishipangere, osho, paumwene. Dira, omakota fanoni, data, momkaro wiri, mwanapareka, okutuma koutumaraka, oku streaminga, nokudenga pamina parates. Konga, parates, Namibia.
Always, always prepare.
Goeie nuus, Imba het nou nog beter geword. Ons het splinternuwe funksies bygevoeg om jou ervaring vinniger, beter en kragtiger te maak as ooit tevore. Is jy gereed om die volle potensiaal van Imba te geniet? Kry alle eksklusiewe funksies vir slegs $36 per maand of spaar selfs meer met ons spesiale intekenplanne. 5% afslag vir 'n 3 maande intekening, 10% afslag vir 'n 6 maande intekening en 25% afslag vir 'n 12 maande intekening. Kies die beste plan vir jou werk en geniet al die voordele wat Imba bied teen 'n onverbeterlike prys. Imba, waar die wêreld saamkom, laai dit af en teken vandag aan.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any of
its. Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Alrighty. So, that was the tragedy now that happened on Sunday. And luckily she didn't sustain like it was a serious wound because it's a gunshot, right? But she didn't pass away, and, she is in good condition and she's fine. So it doesn't always start the way you think it is. And okay, so going back to emotional abuse, the reason, okay, so I'm going to be just running through what emotional abuse is and, how it may impact and all of that. That's the foundation. Then we move to the signs. Yesterday we did the signs until 5. So today we're just going to do a rundown and then we'll continue from 5 to 10. Okay, so emotional abuse involves attempts to frighten, control, or isolate you. This type of abuse doesn't involve physical violence, though it might involve threat of violence directed towards you or your loved ones. You see there, so you are being so bad like this. You know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to kill your child. You know, hey, you are being so bad like this. I'm just going to kill your mother. And that time your mom is maybe an old pensioner. She's 80 years old. She doesn't walk, or 90 years old. She doesn't walk, because we know 80 year olds are presidents now. So they walk. So maybe 90 years old. She doesn't walk and you believe it. You understand? It's categorized by a person's words, actions, and the consistency of these behavior. So the words that you choose. Right? And your actions and the consistency of bad behavior now determines whether or not you are emotionally abusive, right? So if you're being emotionally abused by another person, this is what it looks like. And we are taking it from an internal perspective, because I believe that we are emotionally abusing ourselves. So you can frighten yourself, and some of the scare tactics that we have for ourselves, right, are so sinister that we don't even notice that it's scare tactics. You tell yourself things like me, if this doesn't work, I'll just do this. Like, but you are telling yourself, okay. A scare tactic that is very, very scary is you telling yourself that, if this doesn't work, I'll kill myself. You see? Now, if somebody else was telling you that, it would be a scare tactic and it would be something that is alarming. But because you do it to yourself, you don't see it as something that is very big. You don't see it as something that is very, very critical. You don't see it as something that is worthy of looking at, because, I mean, it's just you, right? But you're frightening yourself. And the more you tell yourself a few things, the more you start to believe them. And then we go to control. Now, how would you say that you want to control yourself? Like, is control not just discipline when it comes to personalized things? I would say that if we are looking at control from an emotionally abusive perspective, right, it would be control in a sense of torture. So you would try and control yourself, right, and monitor yourself and also evaluate yourself and hold yourself back from things that are pleasurable. And pleasurable, I'm not talking about bad things that are pleasurable, because there are bad things that are pleasurable. I'm talking about intentionally choosing to hold yourself back from good things. And we can say that maybe, just maybe, that is a sense of control, because you are controlling yourself, but you are depriving yourself at the same time. So you are telling yourself that I'm not going to go to my family reunion so that I can make them feel bad, but you feel bad about it and you hold yourself back. And what do you think that that does to your heart? You want to go. You want to go and laugh with others. You want to go and chill with others. You want that. But because you are now so far gone in a pit that you dug yourself, right? You say things like, I'm not going to go. And it could also be name calling. I'm not going to go because lately I've been losing a lot of weight. They're going to think I have HIV. Or I'm not going to go because those people are snobs. jobs, or I'm not going to do this. And you tell yourself these things because nobody is asking you, because you have done what? Moving on. You have isolated yourself. Now, part of isolation, isolation is just isolation, guys. Yeah, it is you being in solitaire. Now, where is solitaire? Solitaire is there by yourself. It could be that you are in solitude with your immediates, or you could just be in solitude really honestly just by yourself. So you decide that you don't want to live with anybody anymore, and you go and get a house in Brakvater. Brakvater is beautiful. Brakvater is nice, right? If you are planning on starting a family, if you're planning on farming, if you're planning on doing fun activities that involve you and a piece of land, and you have a plan for it, but if you are moving to Brakvater so that nobody visits you, right, and that you see nobody, and also even when you are at Brakvater, when you see a car driving past, you go into the house and you lock yourself inside the house so that you don't greet anybody and you don't talk to anybody. Nobody even knows the name of the person that lives there. Maybe there's a problem there. Maybe there is a problem there, because now you are taking yourself away from other people. We are social beings, and sometimes we do need solitude, right? But not if solitude is fully alone. You don't have animals to take care of. You don't have plants to take care of. You don't watch TV. Don't want, like, you are literally just in your mind alone. You are creating a recipe for disaster. Not unless you have a project. If you have a project that is going to take 2 years or 3 years, then I understand, because that's work, right? I understand. We do what we gotta do for the bread, for the cheddar, for the cheese. But if it is by choice that you are going to isolate yourself, then I think that you're emotionally abusing yourself. You are sitting in that. Have you ever not wanted company so bad? And the phone rings and then you ignore it. And then somebody knocks at the door and you ignore it. Then you switch off all the lights and you go. You even get onto the ground and then you start crawling to the room so that they don't see you. I don't know what life you've had, but I don't think that that's good. This type of abuse is so faint. It's like a cheap perfume. You spray it now and you leave the scent in your house. You don't go with it. Yeah. It's so faint. It's almost smell through, see through. You won't really spot it. Whether somebody else is doing it to you, whether you are doing it to somebody else. If you are looking at it from the perspective of another person, right? Control would be, yeah, don't wear that. Don't go here. Don't talk to this person. Don't do that. Tell me everything that you are doing. Control, control. That's control from another person. Isolation. You are not going there. Don't see anybody. Who are you talking to? Let's share information. And later on, also the animosity that is built between your partner trying to turn you against everybody. It's go your friend that is not nice. It's go your parents that are not great parents. It's go your siblings. It's go, like, they have something negative to say every day about your immediates. And you start to notice this. With the deeper the love, you start to notice this. And it might not even be the case, because this person is intentionally planting a rotten apple within you. And you start to isolate yourself. You stop seeing your family. You stop seeing your friends. You stop talking to them. You stop everything, all connection, communication, everything with another person that is not approved by your partner. You stop. So that's isolation. And then you become afraid, you know? Have you ever been afraid to talk to, have you ever been in a relationship that makes you afraid to greet someone on the street? Someone that you know. Say now it's a guy from high school, eh? You are just afraid to greet him. Like, oh, hi, how are you? You are afraid because your partner is going to, hey, that guy, hey, you're sleeping with him. Twash, twash. You're like, yeah. I just said hi. You know? So if you are ever frightened like that, then you should consider. You should consider. So people of any age or gender can abuse or experience abuse. And abuse doesn't just happen in the context of romantic relationships. The person abusing you could be your spouse or romantic partner, but they might also be your manager, your parent, caretaker, or even your adult child. You're like, what? Your adult child. I watched this very, 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 very horrible movie. It's something about the Joneses. Is it something about the Joneses? Something weird about the Jones. Yeah, the Jones. Something weird about the Jones. If you're writing this down, write it down and go and watch it. It's a short film. It's very, very disturbing. It's about a young boy that was caught masturbating by his biological father. And this boy was now embarrassed because it's most a private activity, this one, okay, Danina. And then his father came back to him later when he assumed he was done. He came back to him later and told him that, no, my son, this is a natural activity and you must not be embarrassed. And I'm so sorry, me. I crossed personal boundaries by not knocking, you know, because sometimes we don't respect our children. Sometimes our children are exploring their bodies and we just walk in. How? But anyhow. So the father explained that, no, it's a natural thing. And the son was like, okay, do you do it? And the father didn't want to answer that one because you don't really want your children to know that you, those things you did it. We want to be holy in the eyes of our kids, please. We want to be holy. So the father is like, no, it's natural. But did you ever do it? Well, I used to. And guys, that one is tough.
If you've reached that stage in life where you are tired of everything, where each day is just routine, dah, yammer me oh. No, seriously, I am genuinely sorry for you, cause you clearly haven't been polanified. Like, boring day at the spun. Polanify your lunch hour with a delicious Polana curry. Chewing through yet another stale sandwich. Polanify your burger with a little mac and cheese. Tired of chewing the same shandy? Polanify your munchies with air-fried Polana pasta chips. Come on, life's too short for boring. Polanify every moment with Pasta Polana, a proud product of Namib Mills.
All right. So the father is sitting on the edge of the bed and he's basically talking to his son because his son is starting to grow. So he's 15 at the time. He's starting to grow and all of that. So now what we are assuming, because we understood most of the conversation around porn addiction, right? So what we are assuming in this case is that this boy was most probably looking at a picture of a naked hun, you know, breasts out and bikini, what, you know, because I mean, you can't beat your meat to anything else, you know, as a young man. And then when the camera left, because we're going to talk about it from a director's perspective for you to understand. So when the camera left, when the camera followed the father to go out of the door, the camera finally showed us the picture. And the picture was this boy was masturbating to his father's picture. Wild! No. Yes. So this boy was growing feelings for his father. Homosexual feelings for his father. Sexual feelings for his dad. But his dad didn't know this. So eventually over the years, something happened where this child started. You know when somebody says molest is most now for kids. So he started sexually abusing his father. It's such a disturbing movie. It's so disturbing. It's one of those movies where you watch it, and then when you're done watching, you switch off the TV, you go and drink a glass of water, you go and say your prayer, and then you get into bed, and then you sleep and hope that you don't have nightmares. Because we can't fathom it. I think that we have become so accustomed to, we've become so accustomed to child abuse and stuff like that, but not really, parent abuse and that. So, it's wild. Very, very wild.
Listen to Eagle FM in Lüderitz at 91.2 FM. Listen to Eagle FM in Omthea at 90.5. Listen to Eagle FM in Mariental at 101.2. Listen to Eagle FM in Okahanja at 104.0.
At my age, you start appreciating things you might have taken for granted before, like good health. I've known from early on that donating blood regularly was indeed good for my health. I'm too old now, but I've done my part in saving hundreds of lives while benefiting my own. You see, my risk of a heart attack, stroke, and cancer was always low because I donated blood.
Call NHP on 061-285-5400. We're about you.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any of its staff.
Goeie nuus, Inbad nou nog beter geword. Ons het splinter nuwe funksies bygevoeg om jou ervaring vinniger, beter en kragtiger te maak as ooit tevore. Is jy gereed om die volle potensiaal van Inbad te geniet? Kry alle eksklusiewe funksies vir slegs $36 per maand of spaar selfs meer met ons spesiale intekenplanne. 5% afslag vir 'n 3 maande intekening, 10% afslag vir 'n 6 maande intekening en 25% afslag vir 'n 12 maande intekening. Kies die beste plan vir jou werk en geniet al die voordele wat Imba bied teen 'n onverbeterlike prys. Imba, waar die wêreld saamkom, laai dit af en teken vandag aan.
Listen to Eagle FM in Lüderitz at 91.2 FM. Listen to Eagle FM in Omthea at 90.5. Listen to Eagle FM in Mariental at 101.2. Listen to Eagle FM in Okahanja at 104.0.
Alrighty. So it's such a bad story, but it is a story that you guys, something weird about the Joneses. So eventually, this man, he wanted to run away from his abuser. He wanted to run away from his abuser, but it seemed as though one, his wife was just pretending like she can't see. And she has seen the situation many, many times. She has seen it, man, and she pretended not to see it. And this is something that happens a lot amongst adults when it comes to child abuse, especially sexual child abuse, right? There are many adults in households that pretend that they don't know what the perpetrator is doing to their children. And it's so covered up that the perpetrator thinks that they are doing correct things. And, it's so bad. It's really honestly very, very bad. So that is what I was thinking of when we spoke about adult children. Adult children, we are abusing our parents, right? We are abusing our parents we are not financing them, or we are stealing their finances. They are still having to take care of us even when we are very, very big. And we know that parents love is parents love, but to depend is now a difficult thing. And if you can't really, it's okay, but if you are trying, don't abuse the parents like that. Don't abuse the parents emotionally. Don't abuse the parents financially. Don't abuse the parents physically. Don't abuse the parents. Okay? So this is what we're talking about. We're talking about the different kinds of people that can abuse. So it's not just, no. It's just romantic partners. It could be adult children. It could be managers. It could be partners. It could be parents even abusing you at any stage, whether you're an adult or you're a child. It could be caretakers, and it could be anybody. So there are certain things that someone abusing you may use different tactics to undermine your self-esteem. So we can go with name calling. So if we're going with name calling and we are taking this particular emotional abuse from a self perspective, right? What do you call yourself when you're disappointed in yourself? How do you address yourself? Don't you call yourself, oh, I'm such a loser. Oh, I'm so fat. Oh, I'm so, is that not name calling? If we are being honest, is that not name calling? Are you not name calling yourself? Are you not name calling yourself? Are you not being in a bad space here? They may bluntly call you stupid. You call yourself stupid all the time. They might call you loser. You call yourself loser all the time, or use other insults. Maybe they use terms of endearment that actually highlight things you're sensitive about. Little, like my little nail biter. You're sensitive about biting your nails, and you don't like it when other people talk about you biting your nails. And then not a lot of people know that you bite your nails. And then your mother just says it in front of everybody. Oh, my little nail biter. And it feels bad. But then imagine when you do it to yourself, like, oh, I'm such a nail biter. Like, the things you say to yourself, are they not emotionally abusive? Because we like calling other people out, but what are we doing to ourselves? Are we not abusing ourselves? Or my chubby pumpkin. It sounds like very nice. I would agree to being called a chubby pumpkin in secret. But not in front of people, especially if I'm self-conscious about my weight, especially if I'm not ideally comfortable with where I'm at physically. I don't want to be called no chubby pumpkin thing. Like, no. And also, you request the abuser to stop. Please stop calling me that. 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 You know, Blakey. Yeah, Blake is an insult, guys. Blake is for dogs. And now you're like, hi, Blake. Oh, Blake. Stop calling me that. I'm not Blake. And then, if we take it from the personal perspective, when we say that ignore request to stop, we talk about how many times you've told yourself that I should stop this. I should stop this, but you continue with it. So, how is it that we can fire other people, but we don't fire ourselves? Is it because we don't want to notice how bad we are towards ourselves? Or is it something else? And then we have character assassination. I know we had a conversation about character assassination previously. This typically involves the word always. You're always late. Wrong. Screwing up, disagreeable, and so on. They might say these things to you or use them to describe your behavior to others. So you tell yourself that I'm always late. Are you really always late? Are you comfortable with always being late, or is it beyond your control? Is it just the circumstances in which you are in that often puts you in the position of being late? Now you are assassinating your character the whole time. Today it was the driver that was late and you ended up being late. The other day there was an accident. The other day there was a pothole. The other day there was something, right? And then you make yourself out to be a late person. Or you say, I'm so bad luck. Gee, are you bad luck? Because in none of the accidents that happened, you died. So are you really bad luck? Or are you just assassinating your character? within your own, within your own mind, within the comfort of your own mind, are you assassinating yourself? Now, this one might not be applicable, right? But let's run with it. Yelling. Screaming, yelling, and swearing can intimidate you and make you feel small and insignificant. Maybe they never hit you, but they do pound their fists, throw things, or damage property. So you damage property when you are mad. In your own comfort, you damage your property when you're mad. I'm so angry. And then you throw all your nice glasses onto the floor. Like, I'm so mad. Like, I'm so mad. And you are saying that you're not bad. I don't know. You're saying that you don't emotionally abuse yourself. And you start, I think with the violence and the yelling and all of that, then you start telling yourself that I'm an angry person. I'm violent. I'm aggressive. I'm all these things because you do these things. But it doesn't actually mean that. Sometimes you are frustrated, but you take it out on yourself. I think it's an odd dynamic to look at from the perspective of you doing it to yourself, because 90% of the content is addressed to other people. So it's odd, but it's something that needs to happen. So what are the signs? So basically we did the whole introduction of how it may be. And so we have a feel to it now. We have a feel to it. We understand it to some degree. Which, okay, so this is what's up. The number in studio is 0832-888-401. That's 0832-888-401. You can call in and you can contribute to this conversation. And maybe you can ask questions like, if somebody does this, is this emotional abuse? If I do this, is this emotional abuse to myself? If I, maybe, just maybe, you have a few questions. I'm here for it. I am here for it. So we spoke about the five signs, right? The five signs was isolation from loved ones and verbally abusive towards yourself. And you use emotional manipulation, towards others so that you can be in a better light. And, you have a lot of excuses for yourself. So this one is an important one. A lot of excuses, or you don't take accountability. So every single time somebody says, or every single time somebody calls you out on something that you have done, you have an explanation for it. You have a go-to. I'm only like this because when I was seven, the people said that I must watch, and I'm only like this because, and I'm only like this, and I'm only like this, and I'm only like this. I'm only like this because my mom left me in the hospital. There's never a point where you say that, you know what? Here I messed up, and here I take accountability. You always wait for other people to take accountability for things, and you don't take any accountability whatsoever, because, I mean, you think that you are Mother Teresa and you are always innocent and everybody else is always wrong. So that is also must now, because if somebody else was doing that to you, where every time you want them to be accountable for what they did and they blame everybody else, like, yeah, but the reason that I did that to you is because you are so bad with me. Or the reason that I did that is because you deserved it. Or the reason that I did that is because you ignore me. Or the reason that you do this, imagine having a partner like that. Having a partner like that is so difficult. Imagine now if you are the partner that is doing that to yourself. Imagine if you are the one that's doing that to yourself, where everything is everybody's fault except you. Everything is everybody's fault except your own. And you don't take it lightly. Everything is just, yeah, I can't believe that people would do this to me because me, I'm so wonderful and amazing. I'm such a nice person and people are all bad. Every single person is just all bad and me, I'm just great. Okay. So you have infinite scapegoats. You have infinite excuses. You have infinite things that you can blame your behavior on. Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. So the reason I fell is because the stoop was so slippery. Are you sure it's not because you were sloshed and drunk? The reason that I didn't pass last year is because the lecturers hate me. Are you sure it's not because you didn't study? The reason that I'm doing so badly is because people don't get me. Is it because people don't get you or you are a difficult person to be around? I'm just saying. So you use, right? Bad habits to escape emotional responsibilities. Now, these bad habits could be gambling, it could be drinking, it could be women, it could be men, it could be chilling, it could be gaming, it could be bad, because every habit is nice until it's not nice. Then it becomes something else. It becomes a habit, it becomes a routine, it becomes something else. So you maybe use unhealthy forms of escaping your life or relaxing. I hope you get where I'm taking this one. So you use unhealthy ways. So you go out there and then you go and get drunk and you fall over and you do this and you do that. No. And number six, your partner. You might, right, use fear against others and yourself. To control others and to control yourself. So you might scare yourself. Eh? You might scare yourself dead there in that place, which I'm not, because whoa. And you might scare yourself. And I think self-scare equals to anxiety. Because when you scare yourself, like right now, I'm suffering with a fear for vehicles. But I can also say that in most cases, I can say that 40% of it is really just how I hyped up my mind. Because sometimes there's just no other way to drive. And even that's normal driving is scary. So I think I played myself there. You know, I played myself a little bit there when it came to driving. But nonetheless, please hold that thought, ladies and gentlemen, as we start with our, we have one conversation that we're going to hear from another tonight, and we will commence.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have a capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Goeienis, Imbad.
Alrighty. Good evening to you, ladies and gentlemen. We are going to hear from a beloved and world-renowned doctor, right? About, her name is Ramani, D. Yeah, we're not gonna butcher her surname, but her name is Dr. Ramani, and she's going to be talking about narcissism and its discontent. Now, the reason that we're talking about this is because narcissists in themselves don't necessarily go physical. They break you down emotionally and mentally. So that is what we are doing. Now, if we are narcissists towards ourselves. You know, this is a wild thought. It's not even proven that it could be a thing. I'm just saying, if we are narcissists towards ourselves, right? I think that we are treading on thin waters, and most of our problems also are caused by the fact that we abuse ourselves, and we also don't take care of ourselves. Also, disclaimer, we as Eagle Media House do not claim any ownership to the clip that we are about to play, because it is not ours. We just use it for illustration purposes and to make a point. Thank you so much. So in no universe are we claiming that this is our content.
Today, I am going to talk about the most overused, misunderstood, problematic words of our time. A phenomenon, a word that is shaping all of our destinies. That word is narcissism. Narcissism is a word that is being used to understand bad behavior everywhere, in national leaders, in heads of state, heads of corporations, fancy academic types, athletes, celebrities. We actually no longer recoil at their grandiosity, their entitlement, and their incivility. In fact, too many people award them grudging admiration for their successes. And that grants permission to everyone to replicate these abusive patterns of behavior with impunity. Now, things got confusing when people started using narcissism as a clinical term. It became a way of medicalizing bad behavior. It's actually not a diagnostic term. Narcissistic personality disorder is a diagnosis, but it's pretty rare because these folks don't show up to be diagnosed anyhow. So narcissism is in fact a personality pattern. It's a sort of way of relating to the world. It's an adjective to describe their style, much like we could describe someone as agreeable or stubborn or introverted. Some of these patterns are valued by society and others aren't. And the fact is, most people don't receive being called narcissistic as a compliment. It's just, however, a descriptive term. And no matter how much we turn our noses up at it, paradoxically, as a society, we reward it. Dr. Alan Francis was one of the architects of the diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder, and he argues that we actually give badly behaved jerks an out when we call it a diagnosis. If a person's a jerk, then they're a jerk. Disliking a pattern of behavior doesn't make it a mental illness. That so-called jerk has to be experiencing problems in their lives and for their narcissism to actually be considered a diagnosis. So if we were to cobble together all the various things that make up narcissism, we land on a very uncomfortable summit. Narcissism is comprised of certain pillars, as I call them: lack of empathy, grandiosity, entitlement, superficiality, admiration and validation seeking, hypersensitivity, rage, and a tendency to manipulate and exploit people. It's confusing because they're simultaneously under-responsive. They tend to be emotionally aloof, cold, and distant, but then they're hyper-responsive. They have hair-trigger tempers that set off like that when their fragile egos get threatened. So narcissism, however, I believe, is synonymous with pathological insecurity. The key to understanding the narcissist is that they feel constantly unstable and empty. Their grandiosity is actually an immature defense against these threats to them, their sense of self, and they're desperate for the world to keep validating them. On their good days, they look happy, they're great, they're grandiose, but on the bad days, the facade crumbles quickly, and we see disproportionate rage, shame, and vindictiveness. I became interested in narcissism through a couple of different pathways, but the most striking was the fact that more and more clients were coming into my office and talking about relationships in which their partners treated them with utter disregard, indifference, coldness. They lacked empathy. They would question their reality. They would lie to them. At times they were unfaithful. They were inconsistent. And no matter what they tried with their partner, it didn't get better. At the same time, I started working with more narcissistic clients. And would you know, nothing we tried really made things better. In fact, they just remained difficult people, and I don't think I'm that bad a therapist. So it was clear that these relationships were being kept in place simultaneously by hope and fear. Hope that someday it would get better if they kept trying harder, but fear that if they left these relationships, they would be alone forever, without a partner or even without a mother. And some of them had the fear that maybe this is as good as it gets. The world has become more insecure, and the reasons for that are varied. Gallup's annual Global Emotions Report said that in 2017 was the most miserable in about a decade. The report indicated that sadness, anger, worry, stress, and physical pain were more frequently endorsed last year than in the 10 years prior. Now, Gallup speculated on a variety of reasons for this, but let's spitball for a minute. Could it be that this increase in misery could reflect the increase in insecurity, incivility, and tolerance of narcissism our world supports? The increasing insecurity in our world and the platforms that capitalize on it, such as consumerism, have created optimal, fertile ground for narcissism to incubate and proliferate. When human value is driven entirely by external incentives such as success, then qualities such as empathy do not have a fighting chance because we no longer value them and they're no longer valuable. So why do we get pulled into these relationships? We're not flocking to narcissism because we love emotional coldness or invalidation or shallow people. We're drawn in because narcissism is seductive. I call it the three C's of narcissism: charm, charisma, and confidence. That's not to say that all charming and charismatic people are narcissistic. However, we do know that these traits are so seductive that we get drawn in, and they can blind us to the more venomous characteristics that are unfolding at the same time, such as entitlement, vindictiveness, or lack of empathy. So then once a person is in a relationship and it's uncomfortable and it's painful, why would they stay with a narcissist? All of us are vulnerable to those narcissistic charms. And in fact, we may be rendered even more vulnerable to sticking around for the abuse by a narcissist if we originated from family systems in which the patterns of narcissism were normalized, such as having a cold, authoritarian, distant, invalidating, or abusive parent. Our own insecurities render us vulnerable and also less able to climb out when the climate shifts from charm and charisma to invalidation and abuse. Most of us are great at giving second chances, and second chances are in fact the accelerant for narcissism at all levels. When we are in a narcissistic relationship, we make excuses. That's just how he is. He didn't really mean that. She means well. Ah, that's just her culture. And there's the rub. That's how this infectious virus of being in any form of narcissistic relationship, whether with an individual or a family, or a company, or a culture, can slowly proliferate and take over. Most of us issue second chances with zeal. Our storytelling and our culture is immersed in tales of hope, redemption, and forgiveness. And while that's all very healthy, in the wrong hands, hope and forgiveness may not represent an opportunity for growth or change or restoration, but rather permission to just keep things going as they are. Because with narcissists, forgiveness is interpreted as, hey, let's just keep the status quo. Have we created a world in which narcissism as a pattern, as a personality, is becoming necessary to succeed in the new world order? This is where we hit a bit of a problematic divide. The very qualities associated with material success are actually bad for our health. Because while these qualities may be festered and fostered by our cultures and our schools and our economies and our societies, they are never going to be good for our close relationships. And that doesn't just mean spouses and partners. That means parents, children, siblings, extended family, friends, colleagues. Narcissistic patterns undercut the core of what's necessary for healthy relationships. Those things include mutuality, respect, compassion, patience, genuineness, honesty, and trust. Things that are simply not possible with a system or a person which is narcissistic. And it's in that intimate relationship space where we see the most profound impacts of a narcissist, whether that be a spouse or a partner. A relationship with a narcissist is a gradual indoctrination. You slowly become inured to their lack of empathy, their tantrums, their rage, their insults, and their entitlement, their lies and their challenges to your reality. Their insulting words slowly become your self-talk. And before you know it, your new mantra becomes, I am not enough. Anyone who's had a narcissistic parent will acknowledge that it shaped the arc of their lives. It instilled an insecurity and a chronic jousting at psychological windmills. From an early age, narcissistic parents leave a legacy, including an inability to trust your own instincts, to safely enter close relationships, to trust your own abilities, and a lifetime can be spent trying to gain the notice of the aloof, detached, and disconnected parent. The proliferation of narcissism in leadership in our culture, governments, companies, and world has made very difficult workplaces. The narcissistic boss is the insecure tyrant. These are workplaces ruled by fear and subterfuge, abuse and vindictiveness, deceit and slippery ethics. And in the face of the Me Too movement, the top notes of narcissism pervaded all of the stories. The entitled and untouchable tyrant pillaging the workforce, and in most cases, with almost no consequences. The most painful realization is that narcissistic patterns are just not that amenable to change. At a minimum, for any change to occur, the narcissist has to recognize the harmful pattern of their behavior, then they have to want to change it, and then they have to put in the daily work of change. There is a small number of cases where that's kind of happened, but under conditions of stress and frustration, the usual issues of rage will pop up. The rubber band of personality returns to its usual shape and size. The small changes that could be made may not be enough to make a close, intimate relationship sustainable. And if somebody is not willing to recognize that they need to make changes because they're hurting other people, there's little likelihood they will make a change, but there is a likelihood they will continue to blame other people, the world, or you for their bad behavior. So that means that the only remaining strategies are to maintain your expectations and set boundaries, not to try to change that person or waste hope on the possibility of change, but to recognize that this is how it is and either accept it or slowly step away from it. Now, this is very individual, and it's not always possible. If it's your parents or your child who's narcissistic, you may not be willing to sever that tie. Finances, culture, children, or love can make walking away from a marriage or a romantic relationship seemingly impossible, and that's fine. But managing expectations on this pattern can protect you from the downstream effects of this ongoing abuse and allow you to construct a more realistic reality. Sadly, most of us put 90% of our hearts, minds, and souls into our most dysfunctional, unhealthy, invalidating relationships and save the little bit that's left for the people who are good and kind to us. It's time we flipped this skewed calculus and start giving the best of ourselves to our healthy and reciprocal relationships and really only give the bare minimum to the relationships that really aren't helping us grow. Perhaps that's a healthier way of negotiating these treacherous waters of narcissism without losing ourselves in the depths of self-doubt and self-criticism. Now, this can be extended to our thinking about the world at large. It can be small fixes, such as turning off the polarizing discourses we hear and learning to measure our self-worth and the worth of others with new metrics of success, authenticity, compassion, kindness, and empathy. We can learn to tend to our own gardens and not get pulled into hostile interactions that benefit no one. So this begs the question, can there be happy endings where narcissistic or antagonistic personalities and cultures are concerned? I actually think there can be. The greatest challenge about happy endings in real life is that they rarely look like the ones we crafted when we're young. And it's easy to get stuck in our own old narratives. People who come from narcissistic families may feel as though they missed out on having a parent who is an ally or a supporter, even as they go into adulthood. People who married narcissistic partners may find themselves mired in a nightmare of emotional abuse or simply finding that they're actually alone despite being married. Few people write stories of their lives that build in disappointment. I have found that survivors of all kinds of narcissistic and antagonistic relationships actually can and do have happy endings. They just don't look like they thought. All of us are bigger than this epidemic of narcissism. Any of us can change the "you are not enough" narrative that still resonates. We can reparent ourselves. We can look at the entitled shenanigans of people who shriek, "Don't you know who I am?" and realize that you don't give a damn about who they are. Where there are scars, beautiful things actually can spring forth. Khalil Gibran writes, "Out of suffering have emerged the strongest souls. The most massive characters are seared with scars." Yes, the world is in fact becoming more narcissistic and insecure. Don't let the global epidemic of incivility infect you. Inoculate yourself. Find your communities. Find common ground with other people instead of living in polarization. Practice kindness and empathy even when other people are not. Choose your friends and your romances with care. Every life story can be a miracle or a tragedy. It just depends on how you write it. These days, with the world in such disarray, anyone who is surviving with their empathy unbroken, their heart sound, their integrity in place, and their sense of humor intact is nothing short of dauntless. Pushing back on narcissism is a human rights issue. All of us need to stop giving permission to narcissism and narcissists and start taking our lives, our souls, and our world back. Thank you.
Let's talk about abuse. There's a world of misunderstanding and ignorance when it comes to abuse. Why does she stay? Why does a victim of abuse stay under the most horrific, life-threatening situation? Why doesn't she just leave? Why did I not leave? Between the ages of 23 and 28, I was in an abusive relationship. And if you had asked me then to give it a name, abuse never would have come to mind. You see, in my mind, I thought abused women were uneducated, low-income families, and that some sort of abuse was involved in the equation. I graduated college with honors. My parents, so I came from an upper middle-class family. And my abuser, whether he was using a substance or not, was still physically abusive, emotionally abusive, sexually abusive, psychologically abusive. Before I begin my story, I'd like to draw your attention to the screen. Psychotherapist Lenore Walker came up with this theory. She interviewed 1,500 victims of abuse in the late 1970s, and she came up with this theory, and it's called the cycle of abuse. It begins in the tension-building phase. That's where the humiliation begins. The victim may attempt to control the situation by keeping the abuser calm and literally walking on eggshells. The second phase is the incident, the violent, the outbreak. It doesn't necessarily have to be physical. It could be emotional. There's a thing as emotional abuse. It's brainwashing, and it's making the victim believe that she is in danger, not worthy, and useless. After this incident is the honeymoon phase. Now, the honeymoon phase, as it says, the victim responds, the abuser feels remorse, feels shame, and begs for forgiveness. The victim, this is the stage where she normally decides to stay. And I'll tell you why. Because I know she has her power back. In the middle of all this, you'll see denial. And we are not talking about the Nile in Egypt. We're talking about denial, about the elephant in the room that is sitting on my face, and I'm pretending everything's fine. Now, the second slide is again from Lenore Walker. She also developed the concept of the battered woman syndrome, where she finds unique patterns of behavior, emotional, that women have when they become victims of abuse. And it is, many analysts suggest that the battered woman syndrome is also a subtype of PTSD. So I will refer to my abuser as Romeo. And the reason I chose Romeo is because it represents the kind of love I believed in. The kind of love that I saw on television and in movies and I read about. The kind of love that he would die for me and I would die for him. When our relationship began, obviously he did not come to the door and greet me with, "Is that what you're wearing? You look cheap. Oh my God, please don't talk and embarrass me. And if you overstep, you know what's coming." That's not how it started. It started with romance and love, and he hit hard and he hit fast, because that's what abusers do. That's the way our relationship was at the end, though, obviously. But regardless of that, I had become accustomed to men pursuing me because I was a model at the time. And believe it or not, models were pretty insecure. We're used to people telling us everything that's wrong with us to our face and people cutting us down. So I was very, very insecure to begin with when I entered the relationship with Romeo, because he was one of the few men in my life at the time that seemed to really take an interest in me, to really care what I was doing every single moment of the day. I remember at the beginning of our relationship, another model asked me to go out of town to model with her. And I asked him. And mind you, at the time, Romeo was very generous, and he gave me many gifts. I know you're probably thinking, poor little model, oh, poor girl. Well, this is one way of an abuser, how he takes control. He takes control by taking economics in control, in his own hands. So when I was asked to go model at a fashion show outside of Athens, my abuser started crying and begging me not to go. "Please don't go. I'm going to lose you. And if I lose you, I'll die." And me, being a codependent and having problems with boundaries and generally having an allergy to the word no, obviously, I said no. How can I upset the man that I love? How can I do that? So, in his opinion, I had also no reason to go because he was taking care of me. And this is how I handed him over one big part of my freedom. When we first met, he adored my friends. He adored them. Obviously, as the relationship progressed and he wanted to have full control of me, he started planting seeds of mistrust and betrayal of my friends. Obviously, I started backing off and believing that he was the only person that really loved me. Eventually, by this time, I am economically, emotionally dependent on him. And as a result, him having his conquest in his back pocket, he focused on his career and his friends and everything else but me. So I started feeling abandoned. I would linger in the shadows, waiting for him to look my way, to pay attention to me. And this is how our cycle began eventually. Because at some point I got so bored of sitting in the shadows, I told him, I'm going to go work as a model again. And he went crazy. And it was our first violent physical episode. He showed remorse right away, begged and cried for my forgiveness, and I had my power back. I had his attention back. I was his only and nothing else mattered. And obviously, I didn't go. But the abuse didn't stop there. We got into our cycle again, and he started becoming more and more, like he would humiliate me even more. He would make fun of me to his friends, my accent, the way I dressed, anything that you can imagine. He would find, and he would roll his eyes and turn his back on me in front of his friends. He would dismiss me constantly. And when the embarrassment and the loneliness got too much, I would retaliate. And I would say, I'm leaving. I can't take this anymore. And here's the abuse again. Here's the cycle again. He would lash out. He would be physical. He would scream and yell, throw things, break things. And then he would feel remorse. And he'd be mine again. So one night, again in the cycle of abuse, one night when we decided to go out with his friends, he was again in that phase of ignoring me and not paying attention to me at all. And I got into the car, and he looked at me and he said, is that what you're wearing? He goes, you look cheap. Are you looking for a new boyfriend? I was like, no, no. You know, again, I'm walking on eggshells. I have to show him love and attention. I was like, no, I'm just yours and nobody else's. He looked at me, he rolled his eyes, and he said, anyways, we're late. Don't worry about it. He takes off. We went to the club. He ignored me all night while I sat in the corner. At some point, he disappeared completely. I went looking for him to find him at a bar drinking with three women. My heart broke into a thousand pieces. My earth, my world shattered. He didn't love me. It wasn't real. He wasn't really Romeo. And I did the only thing I could. I ran. And he ran after me. In the middle of the parking lot, he started throwing me around like a Raggedy Ann doll. He punched me. He spat at me. He hit me. He threw me in their car. He threw me out of the car. Bouncers were standing there staring. Did nothing. They turned their back. Regardless to say, I broke up with Romeo. And I disappeared. He would try to call me. I wouldn't pick up. Eventually, he had his sister call me. And his sister said to me that Romeo is devastated. He can't eat. He can't sleep. He needs you. He loves you. I said, what? She said, he loves you. That's why he did this. He loves you. I believed her. That moment, when I heard that, a sigh of relief came over my body. All the pain of being away from him was gone. I believed her that the reason he reacted like that was because he loved me. And I knew right then and there that when he came back, when he came asking for me again, I would take him back. Regardless to say, the cycle continued. The hostage taking, the making me feel crazy by irrational behavior, and holding me hostage to his demands. That was the least of it. He would choke me and hit me and lock me up. I would wake up every morning and I would wonder, what kind of mood is he going to be in today? Is he going to be in a good mood? Are we going to have a good day? Or is he going to be cranky? And I'm the one to blame for the red light that's caught us or that the weather is bad. What kind of day are we going to have today? Obviously, this continued on and on. But the honeymoon phase became shorter and shorter to the point it didn't exist anymore. I eventually found out from one of his dear, dear friends, who probably pitied me, I probably looked really desperate, and told me that Romeo had many, many, many girlfriends. And it was exactly what I needed to hear to walk away. Maybe a few months went by. Oh, I forgot to mention, he let me walk away. He was probably so completely bored of me. A few months went by, and I decided to start being social. I started going out. Romeo heard. Athens is small. And he came knocking on my door. I made the huge mistake of opening the door. And to be honest, to this day, that the events of that evening are still a blur to me. What I do recall is at some point in our struggles, he took a knife and he had put it through my throat and said, "If nobody can have, if I can't have you, no one will." And then he lifted the knife up and he came down. I thought, "This is it. I'm going to die. This is it. My life is over." He hit the couch. Somehow, I remember he grabbed me, threw me outside, my sandals in the middle of the street, put me in his car and started driving like a madman up towards the mountaintop and saying, "I am going to kill you tonight. You are dying. If I can't have you, no one will." I was so scared. I really believed him. I really did. And somehow I grabbed his phone and I was able to call my father. And my father negotiated for my life. And somehow he talked him down. To this day, I still don't know what Daddy said, but God bless him. He had called the police as well, waiting for me outside my house. Romeo too embarrassed to take me right to my front door. And scared. He got scared. He left me there. And I saw the red lights and the neighbors all staring at me. And that walk of shame. That shame was, I can't even describe it. And I walked up towards my house. And the policeman looked at me and he said, "Who's your perpetrator?" I said, "No one." That's right, I said no one. Because an addict protects their first love. And that's exactly what I did. I was addicted to Romeo. I was addicted to the pattern of behavior. I was addicted to that type of love. But I knew I was sick and tired. And I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I had to do something. So I told everybody. I told my parents. I told, I had gotten a job at a hospital. I told the security staff there, "If he comes around, don't let him in." I had my best friend move in with me. So that way when he came knocking on the door, she would say, "Go away." And he would. So eventually he did leave me alone. He really did. He let me go. A friend of mine asked me, the one that moved in with me, she said, "How do you see your relationship in 10 years if you go back to him?" And all I felt was turning feeling in my stomach and loneliness and darkness and no hope. Does anybody know what it's like to wake up in the morning and not have hope or dreams? I said, "I can't live like this." He had taken everything from me. The thought was enough for me to walk away and never look back. I was lucky and I was blessed because the next man that I met, he was very kind and gentle, my gentle giant, George Papadakos, and we have three beautiful children together. Around 2006, I was asked to go represent Greece in an international pageant for the Misses of the World. It's called Mrs. Globe. And Mrs. Globe is an annual fundraiser for the WIN Foundation International, Women in Need. And they run programs and name awareness and information and help heal souls all over the world. And this is where I first heard the word abuse. And this is where I put the dots together and I understood I was abused. There was a name to it. It had a name. I won that title. I was so lucky. And with this newfound information and vigorous honesty and learning about myself and how I had to heal, because then the relationship was left behind years. The wounds were still there. They were still deep. I still felt them. So I started arming myself with tools and information on how to heal. And I put my crown to use, and I started Win Alas. And Win Alas has been healing hearts since 2006, informing women about the issues of abuse and offering free programming to them. Despite the Cinderella syndrome and the media bestows on us, and despite my grandmother's belief that I have to find a man that can save me, I'm raising my son not to find a woman in distress to save. And I'm definitely not raising my daughters to believe that they need Prince Charming to save them. So, to all the women out there that don't know they're in an abusive relationship but are in pain, there is information out there. You can heal. And this is a conversation all of us have to be having. It's important to involve men in this conversation. Men need to be a part of this movement. Time is up. No man has the right to suppress you, to hurt you, to make you feel less than. I am living proof that your abuse does not and should not define you. Thank you.
You know that feeling when you know that you're absolutely right about something, you can't possibly be wrong, and yet somehow that other person just doesn't get it. For example, my husband Steve came home the other day from grocery shopping with 5 totally ripe bananas, and I immediately demanded an apology. There are only 2 of us in the house. We're not big banana eaters. No one makes banana bread. And I thought he should be down on his knees with remorse because we've talked about this banana thing several times before. I was already in a bad mood and having a low self-esteem day. So when Steve didn't immediately apologize, I went at him like a trial attorney. How could he? By 5 bananas, knowing that 3 of them would end up in the compost bin. And what kind of person doesn't care about letting food rot in a world where people go hungry? And I concluded with that most tactful of all statements, "What's wrong with you?" Those are the 4 words guaranteed to drive any conversation immediately downhill. Steve got defensive, surprise, surprise, and told me that he didn't want to hear about it, that I could do the shopping myself if I were going to criticize how he did it. I argued back and then stomped off because why was I suddenly the bad guy? I would never buy 5 bananas at the same level of ripeness, which makes me the better world citizen, if not the more highly evolved human being. And why was Steve being so defensive? He should be grateful to receive my constructive criticisms and my helpful little suggestions. Now, banana shopping is not a life and death issue, but some hurtful interactions really matter. And when we don't get the apology that we deserve, it can put a crack in the very foundation of a relationship. Let me tell you about someone I'll call Margot. Margot first came to see me when she was a senior in high school. She was full of energy and talent, and she had a huge gift for empathy and connection. She was also vulnerable to deep depression and would later be diagnosed with bipolar disorder. During her freshman year of college, Margot made a suicide attempt with a drug overdose after her boyfriend broke up with her. Needless to say, It was the year from hell for Margot and for her wonderful family who loved her. When Margot came back home over spring break, she went to visit her favorite teacher from high school, a man who had mentored her and believed in her promise. After some catch-up conversation, he turned to her and said, "Margot, I was sorry to hear about your suicide attempt. To be frank, I felt very disappointed. I didn't see you as the sort of person who would do such a thing." And then, when Margot left his office, he patted her on the back and he said, "I sure miss that old Margot. I hope that strong gal is still in there somewhere." Margot felt flattened by these words from a teacher who had once paid her the greatest attention and respect. She felt like a truck had hit her. In her next therapy session with me, she brought in a very angry letter that she planned to send him. It included, among other things, a summary of the research on depression and suggested reading materials so that her teacher could educate himself on the subject of suicide and self-harm. It was 3 pages, single space. Margot told me that she wrote this letter because she wanted a real apology, meaning she wanted her teacher to really get it. She wanted him to get that he had behaved like an asshole, to use her words. She wanted him to be filled with guilt and remorse and to feel as badly, if not more badly, than he had made her feel. If this was Margot's intention, I suggested that she not mail the letter. Unless her teacher were a highly evolved Zen Buddhist-like person, it would take him about a nanosecond before he shut down. People take in very little information when they're on the defensive and they don't want to hear what you're saying. And if you go on too long, you're actually protecting them because they will vacate the emotional premises. Their apology, if you get one, will be empty, a quick way out of a difficult conversation. Margot took a more courageous route, and she sent a handwritten note that was 6 sentences long. It was a note that he could not so easily disqualify. Here are Margot's 6 sentences. "I'm writing this note because you've been such an important person in my life. I came back to see you needing your support. It hurt me to be told that I've disappointed you, as if I'm some kind of failure. I left your office feeling like I was a smaller person who didn't live up to your standards. Maybe that's what you believe, but it didn't help me to hear it. I also need to tell you that I don't believe that I am a lesser person because of my suicide attempt. Love, Margot." How incredibly brave for this young woman just out of high school and recovering from the near loss of her life to let her teacher know that she would not accept his invitation to view her suicide attempt as something lesser or weak or wrong. Courage is not about blasting or blaming people in hit-and-run confrontations. It's not about demanding an apology. Angry confrontations only invite the other person to see you as the problem and to wrap themselves up even more tightly in a blanket of defensiveness and denial. Now, Margot's teacher, to his credit, really rose to the occasion, and he gave her a very heartfelt, authentic, genuine apology. But when we make ourselves vulnerable, like Margot did, we have no control over how the other person will respond. He could have ignored her note entirely, or he could have given her one of those blame-reversing apologies that only deepen the original injury. We've all received apologies that aren't apologies at all. We hear an "I'm sorry" that makes us sorry that we ever opened the difficult conversation to begin with. But however Margot's teacher would have responded, Margot became a stronger person for sharing her feelings with dignity and maturity. Some people will never apologize, and the more serious the harm, the less likely that that apology will ever be forthcoming. In order to apologize, a person needs to have a big, sturdy platform of self-worth to stand on. From that higher vantage point, a person can look out at their bad behavior, and they can apologize because they can see their mistakes as part of a much bigger picture of who they are as a human being. But some people stand on a small, rickety platform of self-worth. They can't let themselves really see the hurt that they've caused, because to do so would flip them, or threaten to flip them, into an identity of worthlessness and shame. The non-apologizer walks on a tightrope of defensiveness above a huge canyon of low self-esteem. Whether the issue is as trivial as grocery shopping, or as serious as suicide, the rules of apology are the same. If you're the one who wants the apology, let Margot's note be your guide. Focus on how you feel and not on the other person's crime sheet, and keep it short. Don't go on for too long or overload the circuits with your intensity. If you're the one who needs to apologize, drop the defensiveness. Listen carefully to the hurt party's anger and pain, even if you think it's exaggerated. And apologize for the piece that you can agree with your whole heart. If you can get both sides of the equation right, all of your relationships will benefit. And Steve, I'm sorry that I overreacted to those 5 ripe bananas, but don't do it again.
Thank you. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We have heard 3 phenomenal people talking about experiences that many of us put away. Now, most of the time, it is the problem of communicating this. So, let's go. Physical constraint. So if we're talking about physical constraint, we would say that from another person, it would be, even if your partner does not hit you, he or she can still use physical force to abuse you. Some evident signs of It indicates grabbing your wrist tight, holding an arm over your neck or head. And I don't know about the neck part, but I feel like many of us like to pull people. That pulling is bad. That pulling and holding and listen, that forcing thing. So now if we had to put it in our own context, right, I would say it is from activities of self-harm that are actually physical. Like you knowing that you had way too much to drink and then you go out there and you harm yourself and you like, guys, it's intense. And number 8 is depriving yourself of affection. Now, depriving yourself of affection would be you not actually taking care of yourself. Taking care of yourself would be checking your skin, checking your face, making sure that your hair is clean, making sure that your nails are clean. Just basic self-care and personal hygiene is the way that you show your body affection. Now, if you are not doing this, I would believe that you are abusing yourself in one way or another. And you also, you treat yourself like a servant, right? We're taking this from the perspective of somebody else to what we do to ourselves, right? You treat yourself like a servant. So treating yourself like a servant is never taking a day off, never resting, never calming down, never just taking a breather. You're always just on the go, on the run, on the go, on the run. And I know that we are in the era of chasing the bag. I know that we are in the era of chasing the money. We're in the era of trying to survive. We're in the era of raising kids and all of that. But at the end of the day, what purpose does it serve if the body is going to die because you're not taking care of it and you treat yourself like a slave? I'm asking. And you are extremely jealous and possessive. Now, you are extremely jealous and possessive of other people. So you see other people's achievements and you're jealous. I think that you're harming yourself with this jealousy. You want to get into a relationship and you want to be possessive over this person. I feel like you're harming yourself because at the end of the day, people will run away from you because you want to cling on to them for dear life as if they are achievements of some sort. And at the end of the day, we are supposed to be living our lives so that we can have a life to live and our lives don't consist of other people. It depends on the type of love that you want. If you want a love that is clingy, a love that is passionate, a love that is together, right? Then it is rightfully so for you to get that you want. And you must be able to receive it and you must be able to give it. But if it is not what you want and you want your freedom in one way or another, you can't hold somebody else hostage while you have your freedom. So stop abusing yourself. Stop abusing others. Look at the brighter picture. For me, the matriarch, I bid you guys farewell. I hope that my heart some way oozes into yours and we have a good life. I'll see you again tomorrow at 9 p.m.